me in Matthew 9. Last Sunday, I introduced this section. We did half of it. I left you with kind of a cliffhanger, connecting it to this week's study. You know how I love to do that. It's not as bad as the cliffhanger I left for the Thursday night Bible study, though. I told them I left us right in the middle of a point that they'll have to wait a month for the next part of it. But Matthew chapter 9, let's reread verses 14 through 17. Then the disciples of John came to him, saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. No one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch tears away from the garment, and a worse tear is made. Neither is new wine put into old wineskins. If it is, the skins burst, and the wine is spilled, and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins, and so both are preserved." All right, we have been working our way through this two-chapter-long section that follows immediately after the Sermon on the Mount. The two chapters, of course, are chapters 8 and 9. They're primarily a sequencing or a series of amazing, wonderful miracle events, power events in which the Lord Jesus displays the power of God in various miracles. And the main point of these chapters we've been rehearsing is to prove to all who would ever listen to his teaching that he had the authority to teach the kind of things that he taught in the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount was transformative. It's like a completely new way of understanding life, understanding who God is, understanding who we are, and understanding who we are in relationship to him. But it was so radically different that he needed to prove and to establish for the sake of the disciples, because he knew it would be difficult and challenging to fully embrace all that he taught unless they had the assurance of heart that he had the authority from heaven to teach such things. And so these two chapters are a number of significant, powerful, miraculous events to demonstrate that he had that authority. Now, sandwiched in between the sequence of miracles that take place in these chapters are smaller sections of similar kind of teaching. So this teaching in verses 14 through 17 is given right in between a couple of special miracle events. And in this circumstance, what he is doing is he is responding to a delegation that was sent to him. The delegation is a group of true disciples. These are people that love the Lord, who know the Lord, but who have been followers up until this point in salvation history of John the Baptist. They have respect for Jesus as teacher and as rabbi, but they haven't fully disconnected from John and attached themselves spiritually as disciples of Jesus yet. They're in that transition period, and the transition we're talking about is the old covenant to new covenant transition. Now, the problem for them is they don't even fully understand that there's a new covenant that's about to be established. Now, if they had been paying attention to God's word, if they had been paying attention to the scriptures, if they had been paying attention to the prophets, they had sufficient reason to know that there was a new covenant coming. For instance, in the prophecy of Jeremiah, the Lord makes it very clear that there is a new covenant that's coming. And Jeremiah wasn't the only one from the old covenant prophets that spoke and said, that this covenant, this current covenant under which we live, and covenant is just simply the system that God has ordained by which we relate to Him, by which we live out our relationship with the Lord, that this current system of relating to God is not permanent, and it is only, in a sense, preparatory to a newer and greater system of how we are going to approach God and relate to Him. But they didn't fully get that, though the prophets had spoken about it. And we don't really blame them for that. They didn't have nearly all of the information that we have available to us. So these men, as John the Baptist had come onto the scene, these men had responded to the proclamations of John, the preaching of John, the ministry of the Baptist, and they had become his followers. They had become his disciples. They'd connected to him. And they were following out all of his teachings, recognizing him as the latest and greatest of the prophets of God. But they didn't fully get yet, as John himself had proclaimed, that there's another one coming whose sandals, I'm not worthy to even untie his sandals. And that in his arrival, there's going to be a dramatic and radical change of how we relate to God, how we understand our relationship to Him from old covenant system to new covenant system. So we're in this transition point here with them. And in this transition point, they're observing something about the disciples of Jesus. And we saw in our study last week that there was a particular circumstance just before verse 14 in which Jesus had gone with his disciples to eat dinner at a man's house. It was a feast that they enjoyed. And the problem of Jesus and his disciples feasting that night was that it happened to occur on one of the two weekly times that all of the most, apparently most spiritual and most holy people in the community of Israel would fast on those days. They fasted every Monday and Thursday. This was a Pharisaical pattern that was followed. It was followed for the sake of personal holiness, personal sanctification. And here Jesus and his disciples are feasting on one of the Pharisaical fasting days. And so they come to him and say, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" And we notice that Jesus answers their question, but he answers it in a way that maybe we wouldn't expect. He gives them a real answer, a true answer, a powerful answer, but it's somewhat indirect. He answers their question with a question. And not just question with a question, which we consider somewhat rude in our culture, but he answers it not by direct words, but by the indirect words of word pictures. He paints word pictures for them with his dialogue, and he gives them three of them. We covered one of those three word pictures last week. The first is this word picture of a wedding, and it's a wedding feast. Just like it is in our culture today, we emphasized this last week, that it's appropriate when you go to a wedding to, after the ceremony, to go into what we call a reception time and to celebrate. And I don't know, it just really depends on the individual's resources, the couple's resources, the families connected to the couple's resources. But there are some people, even in our culture today, that can throw extravagant and lavish wedding rehearsal feasts. In some extreme cases, they may last an entire day. But in that culture, it was typical and it was normal that if there was a wedding, the feast would last for 7 days. They were big wedding feasters. Can you imagine? Someone gets married And everybody that comes to the wedding takes a week's vacation and just has a big party together for 7 days to celebrate this great transition that's taking place in the lives of the happy couple. Now, what Jesus does is he references that scene, that word picture that they were all familiar with, they had all personally experienced, and he asks the question, can the wedding party be in a fasting mode while the wedding is going on? And the idea, of course, it's what we call a rhetorical question. This kind of questioning with an obvious answer is, no, of course not. It's not appropriate to be fasting when there's a wedding. That's a time of celebration. It's a time of feasting. And so the idea here is, of course, Jesus is painting this picture to connect himself. Jesus, as the groom, his disciples, as the wedding party, and that together they should be feasting, they should be celebrating. Why? Because it's a time of wedding, not an actual literal physical wedding on earth. It's a time of a spiritual wedding. And really what he's doing with a single word picture is he's capturing what many of the prophets in the Old Testament had described in advance and predicted would happen when the Messiah arrived. That when the Messiah arrived, it would be like a wedding celebration as God and his people would be forever married in a new kind of holy union, in a new covenant relationship, because covenant is what a marriage is all about. Covenant is marriage, and marriage is covenant. And so this wedding feast image or picture is Jesus saying, the time for the wedding has arrived. The people of Israel, for all of the generations, from Abraham until this day that Jesus was speaking to these disciples of John, have been in a waiting, anticipatory mode, waiting to find out and to discover when the groom would arrive for the wedding, because you can't have a wedding without a groom. You can have a hope for, a desire for, a waiting for, but until the groom arrives, there's no wedding that can happen. And Jesus is essentially saying, I've arrived. I am the groom. The wedding time is now here, and we shouldn't be fasting. The new covenant is marked as a period of celebratory feasting. So, that's the first word picture. That leads us up to the next two. And the next two, of course, are related to the first one, but related in a different way. The first word picture out of these three is focused on the first word. Let me put it this way. First word picture. I'm just putting WP up here to stand for word picture. Is addressing the moment in history of covenant transition. That moment of covenant transition is the moment of the Messiah's arrival, where he is united with his people in a new covenant relationship. Now, the second and the third word pictures in this series of three word pictures addresses the covenant transition, but not the moment of the beginning of the transition, but every moment after that. Meaning, when the Messiah comes, when he's married to his people, when he forms a new covenant relationship, it's going to change things. And the question is, for the sake of the disciples that were asking him the question, because they didn't get this at this point, and he's just introducing a concept to them. He hasn't completely given all the details of the concept yet. In fact, in the duration of the earthly ministry of Jesus, the 3 years that he taught his disciples, he will not give every detail of how this covenant transition is going to work itself out and what it's going to look like and how much it's going to change. He leaves much of that for his apostles to describe for us in the letters of the New Testament. As Paul works those things out for us in the book of Romans, in the book of Galatians, as Peter and James and John chime in and give each their own assigned perspective from the Lord in the books that they are inspired to write, describing for us all of the aspects of how this covenant change affects the way we relate to God in the new covenant. So these second and third word pictures, though, are going to just introduce the idea of not just that there's a wedding, but what happens after a wedding? What happens after a wedding? You have a marriage from then on for the rest of that couple's life. So the first word picture is a word picture of the wedding. The second and third is a word picture of the marriage. Which is a lifelong proposition. So let's just reread those two, and we'll dig into those two word pictures a little bit this morning together. Verse 16 and 17. No one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch tears away from the garment, and a worse tear is made. Neither is new wine put into old wineskins. If it is, the skins burst and the wine is spilled and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins, and so both are preserved. Now, I had captured, just for the sake of my own verbal symmetry, I had captured the three word pictures with three W words, and that was, the first one was wedding. And then the second two are weaving and winemaking. So, in what sense does a word picture about weaving clothing, and in what sense does a word picture about making wine, teach our hearts about how much our life relationship to God in a new covenant marriage, how much that really is going to change? And remember, it's not just for us, it's for the sake of those that were there that day. How much is going to change the way they've related to God for hundreds upon hundreds of years of an old covenant relationship to Him? Now, Jesus does this by first, as I said, talking about weaving, about making a garment, and not just making a garment, but repairing a garment. He says, no one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. So first he introduces the concept with old garment. All right, what does the old garment relate to? The old garment equals the old what? Covenant. But not the old covenant in every sense. The old covenant, I'm going to use this term and I'll explain this further as we go along in our study today, what I'm going to call old covenant forms. Meaning the practicality of the covenant relationship. Anytime God forms a covenant with a human being or a group of human beings, because he knows that we live real, tangible, practical lives in this world, he gives us tangible and practical ways to connect with him. For instance, this is obvious, but this morning we came to the table of the Lord and we ate. We didn't just take a 5-minute break in the middle of our service and say, think about taking a bite of bread this morning. Think about taking a sip of wine this morning. and imagine what that's like, and then imaginarily swallow that and digest that and think about it from that standpoint. That's meant to teach you something about your relationship with God. What we did was we actually passed out real, tangible, physical pieces of bread and real, tangible, physical cups of wine, and then we waited and we all put them in our mouths, chewed them, swallowed them, and are right now digesting them. Why did we go through all that trouble? Why? Not because I was hungry or you were hungry this morning. We didn't eat enough to satisfy our hunger physically. So why did we do that? Why did we go through the trouble of doing that this morning? And why do we do that every Sunday morning when we gather? There's only one reason. Jesus told us to. I wouldn't do it otherwise. I wouldn't bother otherwise. I mean, it's such a small piece of bread, and I don't even like this bread. I mean, when I go to eat bread, I wouldn't choose this bread. Would you? Kind of dry, isn't it? No salt on it. I mean, it's just not that tasty. And the grape juice is kind of, you know, it's kind of tasty, but I only had a sip. It wasn't enough to really satisfy. So the only reason I do that, the only reason you join me in doing that is because Jesus told us to do that. But he gave us something real, practical, and tangible. Because why? He just knows that we need those connection points. And so he graciously provides those for us. The thing about forms, covenant forms, is that those forms are whatever God ordains for each covenant relationship that he establishes. And in the old covenant, there were certain forms that he established. And in the new covenant, there are certain forms that he established. But once you establish a form, a format, a practical and tangible format for approaching God and relating to him, you get used to that, don't you? Let's just say if some Sunday morning you came and it was communion time, we served a completely different kind of bread. I mean, you would adjust probably, but you'd probably be asking yourself a question. Why did they change the bread? What's that about? What's going on behind the scenes? What's with that bread change today? And everybody afterward, you know, what's with the bread change today? What was the deal with the bread? And if it was something that you just didn't agree with or like about the bread change, you'd probably be talking about it for a while. And then maybe you'd even approach one of the leaders and say, why in the world did you change the bread? The old bread was better. Why did you change to the new bread? We're used to the old bread. And so the Lord understands that. He understands we get attached to the forms that he establishes because they're good, because he gave them to us. They're ordained by him. They're helpful to our hearts. They enrich our relationship to God. There is nothing, not one single thing wrong with the forms that God ordains for his people to approach him and to relate to him. They're wonderful. But we get emotionally and spiritually attached to them. I begin to identify with them. They're ours. And that's a good thing. But then if God himself were to come along later and say, you know that form I gave you generations upon generations upon generations ago, and I've wanted you to use all this time? Stop using that now. Everything is changing. I'm giving you an entirely new set of forms. Even if God himself were to say it, it might be challenging for our hearts to make that transition and to make that change. And that's exactly what was going on at this moment in history. These are God's people that Jesus is ministering to, he's speaking to. And the time has finally arrived where the old is changing to the new. The old covenant is becoming a new covenant. The old marriage is becoming a new and different kind of marriage. And there are new forms that are going to replace the old forms. But the people for literally thousands of years now have been connected to and identified with and attached to those old forms. And they're not easily going to give them up. So, Jesus is gracious to us, and he accommodates our natural tendency to be attached to those things. And he doesn't just blurt it out all at once. He slowly, but surely, begins to introduce this change. And he does so first by giving these initial word pictures. And then later, he's going to fill in all the details through those New Testament letters that I referred to earlier. So in this first word picture, we have an old garment which equals the old covenant forms of how we were to approach God in the old covenant. And he says this: no one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch tears away from the garment and the worst tear is made. What does that imply about the old garment? What's going on with this old garment? It's got a hole in it, or a tear, right? I'm going to date myself, and there's a few of you who go back this far. In the very late 1960s and the early 1970s, when I was in my teenage years, it was the coolest thing to get a pair of jeans and to sew patches on your jeans, even though there were no tears or holes in the jeans. And I had a pair of jeans that had all kinds of cool patches on it. And I was probably just the coolest thing ever in the history of the world when I put those jeans on and, you know, walked down the road, you know, with my patched jeans that didn't need any patches. But the patches were just for decorative purposes, right? That's not what's going on with this garment. This garment is torn. It's got a hole in it. Why? Now we're talking about not new jeans that don't need patches, but older jeans that actually, I'll date myself even further back to when I was a kid. I used to have jeans that I wore and played hard in, and without fail, eventually, both of my jeans would have this big gaping space where my two knees go. Because I was always, I don't know how I was creating those holes, but I was always doing something, sliding, you know, wrestling around, playing around. And for some reason, they always tore right there at the knees. And I would have these two big holes with these two little bony knees sticking out of those holes. And why does that happen? Because we're talking about worn clothing. Not just worn in the sense of I've been wearing them, but I've worn them so much, used them so much, they've gotten so much activity, so much stress, so much has happened that they're worn, what we call worn out. They're worn out. And so now there's holes where they shouldn't be holes. Because understand this, these are covenant forms. And I'm going to use a play on words here now. These are meant to be holy garments. But which kind of holy are we talking about? These are supposed to be, covenant forms are holy garments to be in the presence of the Lord, not old, worn out, holes in them garments. And so here in the image, Jesus is saying, these forms, these old covenant, practical, tangible ways of relating to God have served God's purpose for his people for, at this point, 2,500 years. But they're now worn out. And the time has come for them to be changed. And there's two options in changing the problem here or addressing the issue. The two options are, one, you can patch the old garment. What's the second option? Go to the store and get a new garment. Or, that's our culture, of course. There was no stores then. Weave a new garment. Those were the only two options. So now, there's a wedding that's happened. A new marriage, a new relationship, a new way of approaching God. So you have two options in this new life. You can wear the same garment that you wore before and try to just make it last by patching the old garment. Or you can get an entirely new garment. And his point is, as he makes this point in the word picture, He says, no one puts a piece of unshrunk cloth. What is unshrunk cloth? That's new cloth. So unshrunk equals new. So, okay, he's saying, here's, in essence, what their perspective, the disciples of John, good guys, love the Lord, trying to follow the Lord the best they can, the best they understand to. And here's what they're trying to do by grabbing some of what is related to Jesus, the Messiah who's now on the scene, and some of what the Pharisees have been teaching them, and trying to put those two things together and make them fit together. He's saying that's like taking a new piece of cloth that hasn't been washed yet, hasn't shrunk yet, and using that to patch an old garment. Now, if you do that, if you put those two elements together, what's going to happen? He said what's going to happen is, in verse 17 again, verse 16 again, if you put the unshrunk cloth in an old garment, the patch tears away from the garment. When does it do that? It's in the washing process. The patch tears away from the garment and a worse tear is made. You can try to patch the old covenant forms with new covenant forms, adding some new covenant forms to the old covenant forms. But if you do that, what's going to happen is there's going to be a point of tension between those forms, and it's eventually going to tear apart. And as a result, you're going to create a worse problem. You're not going to resolve the problem. You're not going to permanently fix the problem. You're going to cause a bigger problem. So he's saying to his disciple, to those disciples who will eventually, hopefully, become his disciples, the only reasonable solution for a new covenant relationship is an entirely new garment. You got to start fresh. You got to start all over. Now let's look at the second, and we'll get back to that theme in a moment, but let's go to the second, or the, it's actually the third image, the last image in verse 17. Neither is new wine put into old wineskins. All right, this shouldn't be too difficult. We've got another old thing. The second image had something old. What was it? An old garment. Now, the third image has an old thing in it. What is old in the third image? The wineskin. So now that we know what the old element was in the second image, it's easy to conclude what the old image is in the third word picture. The old wineskin also equals old covenant forms. So he's addressing the same concept in both of these word pictures. But there's something new here. In the second image, what was new was a new patch, a new piece of cloth. Here, what's new is new wine. And of course, new wine equals the new life of the new covenant. So he's saying, okay, here's what I'm addressing is how do these two covenant experiences relate to each other. So let's say our goal was we've received new wine. We've been blessed with a new living relationship with God in the context or the light of a new covenant relationship with Him. So we've got this new wine. How do we preserve it? We can choose to put the new wine, the new life that we've received from our new relationship with God, we can put that new wine into the same forms that we use to contain the old life relationship to God. But if we do that, we're going to encounter a problem, just like we encountered a problem with patching the old garment. The problem here is the skins will burst and the wine will be spilled and the skins in the bursting will be destroyed. So instead, the only way to reasonably preserve the new wine and the skins that are surrounding it to contain it is to put new wine into, the word in our translation here is fresh, but it's literally the word for new, to put new wine into new wineskins so both are preserved, meaning both the wine and the wineskin are preserved. But here's the point. If you put the new wine into an old wineskin, both will not be preserved. Both will actually be destroyed. So the only way to preserve new wine is in a new wineskin. That's the only way it can be done. Why is that? Well, practically speaking, wine, when it's new, is still fermenting. So it's expanding, it's changing. There's activity in this new wine. And old wineskins are stiff and brittle, because I don't know if you understand how they made wineskins in those days. It's a little bit different than how wineskins are made nowadays, or how wine is made nowadays. But basically, they would take like a sheep or a goat, and they would kill it, and they would skin the sheep or the goat, and they would take the skin off, and they would tan the skin, and they would literally sew it back up and sew all of the holes of the skin, you know, for the legs and the rear end and the head, and sew all of that up, putting the wine into the neck and then sewing that up. And now you've got this basically goat skin filled with this new fermenting, growing, changing wine. And if that is an old skin, stiff and brittle, that growing, changing wine is going to just keep expanding until it just literally bursts the skin. So what you need is a new, fresh, flexible skin that can expand and change with the new life that's filling it. All right, so I think we have a handle on our concepts. Now let's talk about some of the implications of what this means for them, what this meant for them, and what this means for us. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Hebrews, chapter 8. Now, I am teaching on Thursday nights through the book of Hebrews, but I'm safe here because it's going to probably be 50 years before I get to chapter 8, because we're only in chapter 3 right now. And by the time I get to chapter 8, even if you're in the Thursday night Bible study, you will have forgotten everything I say this morning. All right, what we're talking about here is I'm asking the question for the title, how new is the new covenant? The answer to that question goes like this. Really new. It's not, the new covenant is not kind of new, sort of new, mostly new, partly new. It's really, really, really new. It's completely new. It's entirely new. But in what sense? Because you can answer the question with the classic yes and no kind of scenario, and you can say, in one sense, the new covenant is completely and entirely new. And in another sense, it's not new at all. So we need to identify in what way it's new and what way it's not new. And I think this is a helpful start in understanding that, because really the whole book of Hebrews is written to address this same issue. The original recipients of this letter were in the same moment in their relationship with the Lord as the disciples of John were the day they went to Jesus and asked him, what's this thing with the fasting and why are your disciples handling it differently than the way us and the Pharisees are handling it? And the Hebrew Christians that first received and read this letter were struggling with the same kinds of things. And they were being tested in the circumstances of their lives, which happened to be a persecution they were under, to pull back from their wholehearted commitment to a new covenant and pulling back to the forms of the old covenant. And so this book is written to fix the flaw in their perspective. And this passage in particular really captures that issue. We're going to read from Hebrews 8, verses 6 through 13. But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better. since it is enacted on better promises. Now, we know he's about to compare Old Covenant and New Covenant. For if that first covenant is which of the two? The Old Covenant. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. It's flawless logic that Paul is using here. He's saying if the first covenant was absolutely perfect in every sense, why would God ever change it? I mean, in one sense, it was perfectly suited to its moment in history. But it was never from the beginning intended to be a non-changing, ever-enduring covenant. And the fact that he has changed it by introducing a new covenant tells us that he had built in a certain kind of obsolescence to the original covenant. Now let's read on. For if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second, for he finds fault with them. This is God finding fault with not the covenant so much, but the community of the covenant, those that were brought into this old covenant relationship with God. For he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers." Okay, so in what way can we say that the new covenant is not the same as and not like the old? Well, he says, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers. It's unlike it. It's new. It's different. On the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, for they did not continue in my covenant. So I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. Now he's describing the moment of the marriage, the moment when the groom arrives, the moment when a new covenant marriage is formed. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, "Know the Lord," for they shall all know me, meaning not every person on the face of the earth, but every person that's part of this new covenant will know the Lord in the way that he wants to be known, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. Now, I've addressed this issue before, but we use this term obsolete to describe things that are worn out by use. Like a garment that you've worn so much that it no longer serves the same purpose that it did when it was new. Or like a skin that is designed to hold wine that served a great purpose when it was first made, but now through a long period of time has worn out, it's become stiff and brittle and no longer can serve the same good purpose for newer wine. We talk about this mostly nowadays in terms of technology. You know, obsolete technology, like Bob's phone, his cell phone. I won't have him display it right now, but you can see him after the service. And you can ask Bob, show me an example of your obsolete technology so that I can understand the point that Pastor Tim was making more fully this morning. And if you ask, I can compare my phone with his phone, and you can see the difference between a phone that in prior generations of ancient technological history served a valuable purpose and was at that moment when it was first introduced a spectacular new innovation, great new technology. Wow, a phone that can actually flip open. And you say, what will they think of next? But then there comes a moment where you say, that technology, while it was spectacular and innovative at its time, in its time, certainly has more than served its purpose. And it's time to fold that phone once and for all and to move on into a new generation of what we now call smartphones, which implies, what about all prior phones? All right, I don't want to digress too much. Obsolete. We know what that means, right? So here, Paul, in writing about covenants, and this is the amazing thing, he's talking about good things, holy things. He's talking about covenant things. And speaking of a new covenant, he is who in this verse, in verse 13? He, God, makes the old covenant obsolete. Now, when you have something that's obsolete, the only appropriate thing to do with it is to set it aside and replace it with something new. Not try to patch it, not try to refill it, but to start fresh. So, what are we talking about? What we're talking about here, and I've left out the last phrase in verse 13, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. So what was happening at the moment that the writer of Hebrews writes this, 60-ish AD, in 10 short years, 70 AD happens. In 70 AD, what happens? The temple is destroyed. What does the temple represent? The temple represents all of the forms of the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, the old way of approaching God. What were those forms? It was things like sacrifice. Things like circumcision. And when I say sacrifice, I'm going to make sure we understand animal sacrifice. Things like special feast days, particular days on the calendar. And I'm just giving three examples. There are literally dozens of examples of the specific forms that God gave his people in the Old Testament. Now, here's the question. Based on the concept that we're studying, both described in teaching in Hebrews, but described in word pictures by the Lord Jesus in Matthew 9, how many, this is a pop quiz, how many of the forms of the Old Covenant are meant to carry on into our new covenant life? The answer is zero. Do not offer any animals for sacrifice for your sins. If you do, you're missing the entire point. Though when Abraham did it, when Moses did it, when Aaron did it, when David did it, it was the most godly thing they could do. But if you do it, you're missing the entire point. How many of us should circumcise our sons in order for them to be assured of having a covenant relationship with God? The answer is none of them, or none of us should do that. Now, does it mean you can not choose circumcision for health reasons? If that's your perspective, you're free to do that. But the point is, it's no longer the basis as a covenant sign, a covenant form, that you have a true relationship with God and you're a member of his covenant. How many of us should set aside the specific seven feast days that are ordained in the Old Covenant law and worship God according to those specific formats that were given in the Old Covenant? None of us should do that because those are no longer applicable in the same way they were in the Old. Now, does that mean that the thing that these were representing, the things these were teaching, the principles that were being conveyed by these forms have also been thrown out? No. It's not a throwing the baby out with the bathwater kind of concept. The idea is, what was animal sacrifice all about? It was all about pointing forward to the cross. Do we throw out the cross? Of course not. We'll never throw out the cross for all of eternity. It's the basis permanently for our relationship with God, and it has permanently replaced animal sacrifice. But we can still read about animal sacrifice and remember how it was that God introduced to his people the concept that one human being would enter into human history and die for all other human beings if they believed in his sacrifice. Circumcision served a wonderful purpose. What is its parallel in the new covenant? Well, Paul comes along later and teaches us that water baptism replaces the form of circumcision. The feast days have new covenant appropriate expressions in our worship that we practice every Sunday when we gather and every time that we gather as God's people. But the point is, the form is not preserved, but the principle that generated those forms is preserved. So the new life finds new covenant form expressions. New life requires new forms. Now, does that mean that because we have new life, we can just go out and start inventing new forms of our approach to God? No. The New Testament letters, the New Testament Gospels, the book of Acts, the various documents of the New Testament give us more than adequate description and expression, all the information we need to know about how these forms have changed, how God has given us entirely new garments, entirely new wineskins, and we hold to those, like in our practice of coming to the communion table, like in our practice of requiring every person that's born again to be baptized in water in the new covenant. All right, actually there was much more that I wanted to say, but I've said everything I needed to say, and that's a good end point for our study this morning. We're at the end of our time. I'm going to miss teaching you for the next month, but I am going to be praying for those that will be teaching you, and I'm confident that what the Lord places on their hearts will be a blessing to you, and I'll look forward to seeing you back here 1 month from today, Lord willing. I'll pray for you. Please do remember to pray for me. God bless.